And I want to impress on you that I'm not an aquaculture person or water person. I really am a microbiologist. So if you've got any technical questions about fish farming, I'm not the person to ask about. I'm more than happy if people want to interrupt because they're confused to raise their hand, and I'll try and deal with that at the time. I just wanted to put this on because a lot of you probably don't know a lot about aquaculture. It's an important source of protein. Aquaculture is becoming a very, very big business. In the state of Washington, it's pretty stable. There's not a lot going on, but if you look at other parts of the country, other parts of the world, it's a place that's really growing. It provides a lot of jobs, and it is very important to a variety of countries. This is a little old, but the latest I found, and it just tells you sort of how much money aquaculture is, and just look at the acreage for catfish farming, which is in the southeast, and then salmon farming, which we have some of. And one of the things I didn't realize is we also have an ornamental fish industry, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end. But these are a little out of date. It's from 2004, and I'm sure everything's gone up since then. 40% of the world's fish that's consumed is farmed in one way or another. And in some countries, over 90% of the fish consumed is farm-raised. And that depends on the kinds of fish you're talking about. Salmon in much of Europe is 100% farmed. They don't have any wild runs left. Similarly, most of what Japan eats is farm-raised. There's a few species that they still collect in the wild. There's a couple of different kinds of aquafish farming. The marine system, which is what we have in Washington State, usually is a open system where there's nothing underneath the fish net. Food and waste just drops to the bottom. In some places, such as in Norway, they actually have what they call a diaper, which collects underneath the fish farm net and actually prevents the food and the waste from going to the bottom of the pen. And then there's a lot of land-based systems, which are usually closed, except for the fact that if you have a hurricane, if you have any kind of major disaster, all of that sort of gets washed away. And seepage certainly occurs throughout the system. Wanted to just give you a couple pictures. This is the way fish farming is done in Asia. In a lot of places in Japan, the bay is totally covered by different fish nets, which have fish being raised. They're often different kinds of fish. In some of the bays, you can literally walk from one farm to the other without even getting your feet wet. In Asia, most of these are small farms, and a lot of them are quite old. There is relatively little regulation, even in places like Japan. And not to forget the ornamental, this is a koi farm, and it's pretty amazing. And so some of the ornamental fish farm type things are very sophisticated. And I just wanted to show you what that looks like. When you start looking at the bacteria associated with aquaculture and both the environment as well as the fish, you've got pathogenic bacteria, which means they're able to cause disease either in fish and or people. And you've got a lot of bacteria which are not pathogenic, but are part of the normal flora of the environment and or the aquaculture environment. And the reason these are important is because they can act as reservoirs for antibiotic-resistant genes, which then can donate them to the pathogens. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. There's also probably a lot of other bacteria that we haven't cultured yet, either because we don't know how to culture them or they are relatively rare in the environment. So this is the tip of the iceberg of the number of different bacteria, and these are only the aerobes, and there's a whole another group of anaerobes, which are organisms that grow in the absence of oxygen. Okay, how do bacteria move? Well, it's pretty straightforward if you're talking about an open marine-based system. The food drops to the bottom, the waste drops to the bottom, but it also spreads with the tides. And bacteria can hang on to the food and the waves or are part of it and move along with the tides. And that's why in the West Coast, the fish farms tend to be in fast moving water, so everything gets flushed out pretty easily. You can imagine if something was at the bottom of Hood Canal, you're not going to get a lot of flushing activity. And the difference is with the land-based, everything just drops to the bottom, and you may end up with 5 or 6 feet of muck, which more or less is stable except for seepage. But then, at least in North America, these are in the southeast part of the country, where you can get floods, typhoons in the eastern other part of the world, hurricanes, earthquakes, and then all that can get washed out to sea as well as spread everywhere. So they're relatively close, but only relatively. And also bacteria move with the fish, with the eggs, with the food that the fish are given, as well as the fish. Think about it. We can go buy fish fertilizer for our garden, and you can actually get bacteria, live bacteria, coming out of that. And also shipping material. That became a major issue when South America suddenly became reintroduced to Vibrio cholera. And the salmon that come from Chile get packed in ice, and the ice was in contaminated with Vibrio cholera, not something you want your ice to be contaminated with. And the USDA spent a long time trying to figure out how to decontaminate the ice and never actually got it to work. As a consequence, we don't get very much fish products anymore from South America unless they're vacuum packed because of the difficulty in shipping. And it's not the bacteria, it's not the fish, it's the ice that they've used for packing. And that's been a huge economic loss for South America. If you look at what fish farms do to the environment, if you look at the sediment prior to starting a fish farm, it has relatively limited amount of bacteria. But as you add nutrients due to the food, which isn't always eaten, and the waste, you can increase the bacteria population a lot. And you can also increase the population downstream of where the food and the feces gets washed, so that there is an impact. Similarly, if you look at the land-based, at the bottom of the pond, the bacteria become quite heavy. In this case, a lot of them may be anaerobes, because as the muck grows, there's not a lot of oxygen. But if you look at culturing anaerobically, you'll see a myriad of different organisms, many of which we really haven't well defined. So there is an impact, even on the best circumstances, of bacteria by increasing their numbers tremendously, because they've added a huge amount of nutrients to that particular environment. I'm going to try and give you a little bit about antibiotics, and most of you, I assume, have had antibiotics at one point or the other, or a family member, or a household pet. Antibiotics first became widely available in the 1950s. They are used for treatment of disease in man, animals, plants, and fish. In North America, they're also used as a preventive measure. That is, lots of the chickens we have low-dose antibiotics from the time they're hatched to a couple weeks before they go off to market. If you go to Europe, that has all been banned now. It has not been banned in North America, probably never will be. They're used also to treat non-infectious diseases, such as acne. And many, many of you probably have had antibiotics to treat your acne, or rosacea, or other skin ailments. So antibiotics are not just used for infectious disease, they're used for non-infectious diseases as well. In some places, such as Japan, the number of agents that are used for non-infectious diseases is much larger than what you find in North America or Europe. As a consequence of antibiotic use over the last 50 years, antibiotic resistance had really developed in response to our use. Prior to the 1950s, we didn't see very many bacteria that were resistant when we went and looked at cultures from the 1900s. So resistance has really been a man-made event, and it's the way bacteria have, in fact, responded to our use or abuse, as some people will say, of antibiotics. Most resistance is due to the presence of new genes in bacteria, usually associated with elements that can move from one isolate to another, from one cell to another, so they're mobile. And these genes can move between related and unrelated bacteria. So if you get a organism that has these genes, if you put that antibiotic in the environment, often what will happen is it'll promote that organism to transfer its genes for resistance to all of its neighbors. So the ecology very quickly changes from that of a susceptible population to that of a very drug-resistant population. So it's relatively easy to spread between ecosystems. Sometimes we know how that happens, and a lot of times we don't, which I'll go over. And this is sort of the critical thing that's very interesting, is EPA now considers antibiotic-resistant genes contaminants in water and in soil which need to be contained. And whether they're going to do a very good job, only time will tell. Well, this is my very one slide on bacterial genetics. This is a mobile plasmid which may carry antibiotic-resistant genes, and in fact can transfer from the donor to the recipient, and then the recipient can then transfer back to new organisms. And so it's very easy to get resistance in a large number of different bacteria within an ecosystem. And clearly those bacteria are able to transfer these genes into a lot of different ecosystems, even though the bacteria in the different ecosystems probably have never met. And I'll talk about a case later in the talk. So what happens if you have drug-resistant bacteria? Well, you have reduction in the therapeutic options. Unfortunately, in today's economic situation, most pharmaceuticals are not looking for new antibiotics to use for therapy. As a consequence, we're running out of antibiotics for treatment in a number of diseases. Cost of treatment is higher, treatment can be longer, and you can have increased mortality. Just in the last 6 months, there's been some what they call extreme drug-resistant Mycobacterium tuberculosis, first showing up in South Africa, now in Canada, and we really don't have any drugs for treatment. As a consequence, the likelihood of those patients dying is much higher, and the likelihood of spreading that organism is also much higher. So eventually, we're going to be back to an environment very much like what we had prior to antibiotics coming on the scene, where we're not going to have drugs for treatment, and we're going to have to go back to things like surgery to cut out infections, quarantine, where we just prevent people from moving freely so that they don't spread disease, and a lot of other rather archaic measures to try and keep resistance bacteria disease in check. All right, tetracyclines was one of the first drugs used widely in the world, and it also has been used extensively in aquaculture. And if you look at what was done way back in the 50s, very, very little work was done before they started using tetracycline in aquaculture as well as in land animal use. Salmon and other fish often have the antibiotic in their food because it's much easier to do it that way. That way, when they're eating, they actually pick up the antibiotic as well. Salmon and some of the other fish that are, in fact, fish farmed eat other fish. So what is happening is the food that is provided often is simply ground up baby fish or ground up fish of another type because that's the kind of protein they need. In Japan now, most of the salmon farming, the fingerlings are actually grown in China, and then they're transported to Japan for their final growth. And if you watch what's going on, they take all the dead fish, grind it up, throw in penicillin paste at some level, and then feed the fish. And the reason for that is if they just grind up the dead fish, it's toxic. So they think, well, adding this green paste, which they don't know what it is, other than it's some crude extract of penicillin, prevents that from happening. And so that's what happens. Then the fish are brought to Japan where they're raised. The other issue, just like with other farming, is that the fish are all genetically identical. So if you get a disease, it's going to go through the fish farm very quickly, just like in chickens or pigs or whatever. And as a result, tetracycline-resistant bacteria associated with aquaculture has been around almost since the 50s. And that's why we looked at tetracycline resistance, because we knew we would find it. This is what, I think you can sort of see it. It's a catfish farm out in the southeast. They're just huge ponds with little dikes, and in here is where all the catfish are, and they go through once a day or once every 3 days and feed them, and then they'll put the nets in and take the fish out. The ponds don't often get drained. They just sort of raise the dikes unless there's been some sort of natural disaster or something else. Occasionally the dikes break. But it's a huge, massive operation. And catfish farming is very big business in the southeast part of this country. Our first study was looking at some of the catfish ponds with a guy from USDA. He was getting his PhD. And what he did is he wanted to look to see what the food looked like, as well as some of the organisms in the aquaculture system. And what he was surprised is that he found bacteria in the food that was drug resistant. In addition, you can either buy tetracycline supplemented food or non-tetracycline or antibiotic free food. So he took bags from the local place that were labeled tetracycline containing and those that were not labeled, and found out that the ones that were not labeled had varying amounts of tetracycline in the food. So even if people were trying to use food that wasn't supplemented with antibiotics, they were giving their fish variety of doses. And what the reason for this is, what happens is they'll go ahead and do a run of food with tetracycline in it. Then they're supposed to do a couple of runs and throw that food out so they clean up the machinery. Of course they don't, and they just label that as non-supplemented. And this is an issue, because if people are trying to be organic and they don't want to use antibiotics, they may still be getting it because they're not definitely knowing whether or not their food is in fact containing some antibiotics. It was a little bit disconcerting. What we found when we looked at the genes is that we found some genes that were commonly found in bacteria associated with disease in man and animals, land animals, but we also found some novel TET genes that hadn't previously been found from man or land animals. And we also found that there's a lot more what looked like diversity of the TET genes than what had previously been found looking at primarily human but also some land animals. And our data suggested that some of these novel TET genes may preferentially be associated with water bacteria. And this was back in the early 1995. And unfortunately for us, I guess, this seems to continue to hold as we go through. The next study we did is a colleague came up from Chile, and we looked at some of the organisms that he had acquired from fish farms. It's the second largest producer of salmon products, almost two times what the US produces. Norway is the number one producer, and in fact most of the fish farms in North America have a link to the Norwegian farms, companies. It's a major exporter of salmon. It doesn't come to the U.S. very much anymore because of the ice issue. They have in the past used extensive amounts of antibiotics, and this is part of the world where you can get antibiotic without a prescription, so that you can easily go to the corner or to the pharmacy and ask for pretty much anything you want. So when you look at human disease, there's a lot of drug resistance in this part of the world. And the question was, does that translate into the environment? And unfortunately, the answer is yes. This is where the fish farms were, 1, 2, 3, and 4, little island, and here's the coast in Chile. Pretty far down, just down at the bottom here. All of them were freshwater because we were looking at very young fish and they lived in freshwater. Three of them were land-based, one was water-based. In other words, the three land-based were in big tanks that were on land, and then the one was actually in the water. They were not supposed to have gotten tetracycline for at least 6 months, which we hoped was reality, but sometimes it's hard to always verify that that's the case. Cultures were from the water, going in, coming out, surface water, the non-medicated food, as well as the baby salmon. That's all the different kinds of bacteria. Each is a different genera or species. And most of these are considered non-pathogenic, part of the natural environment, and you would not necessarily even find them in people or in animals in general. Some of these are strictly water organisms, and a lot of them are not. You get Escherichia coli, which virtually all of us carry, and everybody who has an intestinal system has E. coli. And some of the others we just don't see very much. This is what the tetracycline looked like profile. This is over 1,000 micrograms per mil. Therapy is sort of down in this range. So these are all very highly resistant. We went and selected 103 of the gram-negative bacteria. We took a lot of them that were novel, that hadn't been described or worked with very much before. 72% of the organisms were also resistant to anywhere from 6 to 10 other antibiotic classes of drugs. In other words, these were very drug-resistant bacteria, with MICs ranging from 128 to over 2,000 micrograms per mil. This range is not even something you can get in any sort of a person or animal system at all. We also found viable tet-resistant bacteria in commercial food pellets that were not supplemented with antibiotics. Part of that is because, again, what they do is they do take fish and grind them up and then make them into pellets to feed the new fish. And so if you've got tetracycline-resistant bacteria in your food source, it's going to be transmitted in with the food. So it's sort of a vicious cycle. Even though they haven't really seen any antibiotics for 6 months, there's enough bacteria around to keep those populations pretty content. We found tetracycline reduced genes in 40 to 80% of the isolates from each of the strains, that is, known isolates, known genes. They were found in fish food, the fish, and all the water samples. So every sample we found, we looked at, had bacteria that were tetracycline resistant in that particular place. 60% had known TET genes, and 40% had unknown TET genes. And virtually all of the known genes have been identified in either people or land animals, so it's not that surprising if we hypothesize that there are some genes that are pretty unique to water bugs that, in fact, you'd see some new genes. Again, similar sorts of diversity as we saw with the catfish. And again, it seems that the same novel TET genes that were found in catfish bacteria are also found associated with the salmon. So there appears to be a common theme, that is, there are some differences between water organisms and other organisms. And unfortunately, other than these studies in Japan and studies in Norway, there's very little work being done on bacteria associated with aquaculture or water of any sort. Okay, hopefully maybe some of you can recognize this. This is what salmon fish ponds look like in Northwest. This is actually up in BC, and they're all up mostly where it's unpopulated next to islands. The ones around Puget Sound usually have a tether so that you can walk out to them. They're not just sort of free floating. BC1s are free floating because maybe a couple people will service maybe 10 or 20 of these, so they go around with a boat. The ones locally tend to be pretty much stationary, though in the past we've had a few fish farm try to move the fish pen along with the fish from one place to another, often losing fish in the process. But that's a classical salmon farm. And in the early 2000s, I was contacted from some people in eastern Canada who were having some issues with their fish farms. And eastern Canada, when you go to look, it's not as big a producer as BC, but it is being heavily subsidized by the government because they find it's very important to the rural communities because it provides good jobs. So it allows the young people to become educated and then stay in their communities. And so there's a huge amount of provincial as well as government support. In BC, there's not as much because it's much more established and because of there's a lot more economic and employment opportunities. They don't feel that that is absolutely vital. But in eastern Canada, where there's a lot of unemployment, they really believe fish farming is one way of changing the economic outlook of many of the people in this area. So what they found is some an atypical salmonella that was causing disease, and this was first identified in 1989, and it causes furunculosis, which is a really nasty disease that kills the fish. They found this organism carried a unique plasma. This was first described in Norway. Not surprising, there's over 900 fish pens in Norway, the largest in the world. They found that between 1992 and 2001, they had a lot of problems with furunculosis in the hatcheries and the sea cage sites. And this was both for salmon and trout. Trout is related to salmon, so many of the diseases that hit salmon will also hit the trout. And in eastern Canada, a lot of their pens are pretty isolated, just like they are in BC, but it was going through everything. So they asked us to look at the bacteria from 1992 to 2001 and tell them whether or not they were having different organisms come every year or whether the same organism was hanging around and just causing the disease. If it was a new organism, they would do one thing. If it was the same organism, then they had to do something different to try and get it out of the environment. And we went and tried to decide what, in fact, was happening. We got 9 of these atypical Aeromonases, and they grow at very low, 4 to 15 degrees C. So I had to put them in a cold water bath that we actually goes down to about 10 degrees, or actually we grew them in our refrigerator, which is about 4 degrees, because I didn't have a cold incubator, not something I normally use. They take about 2 to 4 weeks to grow up. Non-atypicals take about 24 hours, so these guys are very slow growing. It's amazing they can cause the kind of disease they do. We found that all of the 1992 to 99 carried Tet A on a plasmid that was all related, and that the strains themselves were all related. So from 92 to 99, clearly they had essentially one organism with some variability hanging around in this environment. And so obviously they weren't getting it cleaned up properly. And then in 2001, we didn't have anything between. A new isolate appeared, which carried a different Tet gene and a different plasmid. And so for a long period, clearly the organism that was causing the yearly outbreak was in the environment, and they weren't getting the environment cleaned up. Then actually, after 1999, they moved a lot of the cages from one place to very different places. And that seemed to help them get rid of this one that had been hanging around for a long time. Then they picked up a new one, which presumably came just part of the wild and came in to their new sites. So things have gotten somewhat better now. They are monitoring more closely. They're also changing their locations quite frequently from year to year, so that they're trying to make sure that the organism isn't going to be maintained in their population. With these fish farms, what they normally do is all the fish come to market pretty much at the same time, so they actually empty out the cage, and then they can move it, and then repopulate it with small fish and let them grow again. The other thing that they're doing in eastern Canada, which is sort of interesting, not only for salmon, but for all kinds of other fish and things like lobsters, is they're they're catching in the wild small animals and fish that are below market value, bring them back, and then hand raising them in ponds, in fish nets, till they reach marketable size, and then selling them. And that was something I wasn't aware of before. So these are wild caught animals. So they are getting wild and hatchery animals in the same environment. We are not allowed to do that. If you've got an undersized fish, you can't keep it and then raise it till it gets big enough. But Canadian, Eastern Canada anyway, is doing that. I don't believe this is happening in BC as well. So that was sort of an interesting twist. This disease also cycles, and right now I think we're in a low cycle, so things have gotten better, but I think also their ability to sort of move and clean out and move to a different spot probably helped get rid of their massive outbreaks. The other thing that we looked at is whether or not the plasma could be transferred to E. coli. Now, E. coli grows only to 15 degrees C, and the atypicals only grow to 15 degrees. So we grew them together in 15 degrees, and in fact we got transfer. And this is the first time the transfer has been actually documented to occur at 15 degrees C, which is fairly cold, but not for our waters. And certainly you get up to Alaska, 15 degrees isn't that uncommon. So these experiments suggest that we can have direct transfer from these atypical Aeromum samosidus into E. coli, and E. coli by its nature is able to go virtually everywhere. It's in all animals that have any kind of a gut. It's in the land. You can find it in water environments, so it's a very good all-purpose organism. And so this was sort of our first indication that we can get direct transfer from really water organisms, which are causing fish disease, into an organism that can be transferred to every environment you can think of. And the environmental microbiologists were quite excited about this. Up until then, 20, 25 degrees was the lowest anybody had seen gene exchange. And this is not work that I did some consulting with to show really how important some of the water bugs are. And Chlamydia suis, chlamydia is an intercellular pathogen. It only grows within cells, and once it's outside a cell, it is not able to grow. It just sort of sits there. And what they found down in Oregon is there was a 10 kb region from an Aeromonas samosida plasmid, which carried a different cat gene, and they actually found it in this Chlamydia suis from a pig. And Chlamydia suis is a quite important pig pathogen. And it was from some Midwest farms that used tetracycline as food additives. Now, the question is, how did this happen? Because Chlamydia suis only lives within cells. It's unique to pigs, so you're not going to see this organism anywhere else. Aeromonas samosida lives in the water or in fish. They only grow to 15 degrees, and I can guarantee you the inside of a pig is not 15 degrees C. So the question is, how did this happen? And also, because Chlamydia suis is only metabolizes and functions inside a cell, it indicates that you had to have another organism with this set of genes co-infect the same cell. And so it's the first documentation of horizontal gene transfer into an obligate intercellular bacteria. We have chlamydia diseases like trachoma and syphilis, which is a zoonotic disease, and rickettsia, which is another set of organisms, all intercellular pathogens. So this really suggests that those organisms now can become resistant by acquiring genes that are already out there. And it turns out that all of these diseases use tetracycline as one of their major drugs for therapy. So this is a little bit disconcerting. We don't know how it happened, but it would be very nice to be able to figure it out. Obviously, there's got to have been at least one, if not multiple, intermediaries that went from the fish into something that then could coexist with within the bacterial intestine of a pig. But this is a little bit disturbing, and I suspect in the coming years we're going to see a lot more tetracycline resistance happening. And this particular gene actually is not as common. I would have predicted a different one. So clearly, the water organisms are acting as a reservoir for some unexpected results. I want to talk a little bit about a real recent thing that happened, and this is not a study that I'm at all involved with, but it has to do with tropical fish, and it actually happened in Australia. But 12 million Americans have ornamental fish tanks, and I don't think that includes things like koi, which tend to be outside. In Australia, in 2000, there was a new multi-drug-resistant Salmonella paratyphi, which can cause quite serious gastroenteritis, identified. Now, Australia is really a big island, and they only have 20 million people there. They have very, very good records. Everybody's in the national health system, so they keep very good surveillance. And all of a sudden, this new organism, which was very drug resistant, started appearing. And they went to look and found that the organism was only in people that had ornamental fish tanks. And most of them were children. And what they found is that it usually happened after the kids had cleaned out the fish tanks, and they were cleaning them in the kitchen. So the dirty water was going into the kitchen, and then they were getting the new water and putting it in. And a lot of the kids were 8 to 10 years old, and clearly they were getting water that they were draining into themselves and infecting themselves. Most of the fish were imported from Asia, and what they do in Australia is they're quarantined for a month to 6 weeks, and then treated with every antibiotic they can think of to try and get rid of the pathogens or potential pathogens. Well, what they ended up doing is selecting for highly resistant Salmonella, which then went out to the stores, and the people bought them, and they weren't affecting the fish. The fish were not sick, but when the children were in fact cleaning the tanks, they were managing to infect themselves. And so it was really the very first time that ornamental fish tanks as a potential reservoir for antibiotic-resistant pathogens. They put out a bunch of suggestions, including small children should be monitored when they're cleaning their fish tanks, not to do it in the kitchen because they may not have infected themselves, but the kitchen sink may have been contaminated, and then mom could have washed or prepared food and picked it up that way. They're also reanalyzing their quarantine process, because obviously this is not working very well. And the problem is that this little guy is virtually resistant to everything, so it's not something that's going to be very easy to get rid of. One of the things Australia is doing is starting to raise more ornamental fish themselves, and so they won't hopefully have this. But it's really been a fascinating study on trying to do something good and ending up actually making things a lot worse. But the reason that this was identified is you start seeing people coming down with a disease with an organism that was very different than anything else, and somebody was very bright, did ask the correct questions to find out that all of these people, or most of these people, had ornamental fish tanks, which is pretty nifty, because it's not something that would pop into somebody's mind as a first. You would usually think it was foodborne, but they were lucky. And the organism has been virtually identical, and they're trying very hard to educate everybody who has ornamental fish tanks. So if any of you have tanks, you might think about not using the kitchen sink as the place to dump the water. Okay, so hopefully I've tried to show you that aquaculture bacteria can be a reservoir for human bacterial pathogens. They can actually be a reservoir either directly or indirectly for antibiotic-resistant genes for both man and animals, as well as infecting ecosystems. And once resistant genes are in one bacterium, they're able to move to a lot of different bacterial populations. Nobody would have predicted an Aeromonas that grows only to 15 degrees C. Part of that plasmid was going to end up in a Chlamydia suis, which only grows within cells in pig intestine. That is just a very wide jump. But clearly, once they're in any bacterial population, given enough time and inclination, you're going to find genes and or parts of plasmids, bacteria, in a lot of different ecosystems that are totally unrelated. We really need to think of the world as a single connected system. And for many, many, many years, you know, people have thought of very isolated, we're isolated from Europe or Asia or whatever. And there's so many ways that we aren't isolated. We get fish food, we get fish, we get all kinds of things coming in all the time, either by boat or by air, in food products, as packing material, as hitchhikers and people or on planes. And so we really need to sort of change our sort of parochial thinking to something that's much more world-centered rather than just continent or country-centered. Because unfortunately, bacteria don't recognize boundaries, and they're perfectly happy moving wherever, and they're not going to stop at a border. Aquaculture practices in the developing world does impact us locally. And aquaculture, if you enjoy the big prawns, they're all raised in farms in Indonesia. I guarantee you, you're going to have drug-resistant residues potentially and drug-resistant bacteria on that food. Certainly, our government does monitor, but often it's monitoring when somebody gets sick. And they just do not have the manpower or the technology to look at every product that's coming in for consumption. Foreign-raised food may contain antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They may contain residue. Locally raised also may, but not as likely. And so people tend to need to think about where their food's coming from. And in places like Australia and Europe, they list where every piece of food is coming from. So you know if it's from South Africa, you know if it's from Indonesia. And Australians are, as a government, has really made an emphasis to try and import very limited kinds of food and mostly raise their own so they have a lot more control over it. North America has not really done that. Europe hasn't really done that. But personally, I do watch how many big prawns I eat in a year, just simply because they're going to be less, more likely to have things that I don't want. Just like if you eat a lot of fish from the Duwamish, you're probably in pretty poor shape. You don't want to do that either. So we need more surveillance studies. If you look at aquaculture, there's really not a lot of work done. And we need to look at what's going on, not just in isolated places like Norway, where they do a huge amount of surveillance, but other parts of the world, Indonesia, China, Japan, South America, etc. And fish farming is a big push with WHO for Africa. And I have a colleague whose father works for WHO, and in fact is trying to get fish farming as a local way of producing a lot of protein. Now, how successful they'll be, I don't know. It's unlikely we'll see any of that product in the West Coast. But if you go to New Orleans, a lot of the crayfish come not locally, but from Africa. So it depends on where you are and what kind of food products you're looking at. But most of the crayfish you're going to get in New Orleans or any other place in the South originally grew up in Africa and then was shipped over. Tet genes in aquaculture-associated bacteria are diverse and can differ from those found in man and animals. I don't think that's all that big of a leap considering the difference in body temperature and everything. And what we don't know, and is something I'm interested in, is how these genes move between bacteria and around the world. And that's certainly something that would be very nice to know a lot more about. Aquaculture exposes many new bacteria in the ecosystem to antibiotics and residues and resistant genes. We need to better define the risks that antibiotics and resistant bacteria pose when it's associated to aquaculture and the environment, the aquaculture stock, as well as man and animals. And I think we need to start realizing that aquaculture bacteria are a reservoir for antibiotic resistant genes and their associated mobile elements, and that you can find these genes in a lot of other environments. And that evolution of acquired antibiotic resistant genes and associated elements is an ongoing process, which may differ from different ecosystems and from different geographic areas, but it's something that needs to be continually monitored. If we look at stuff from the 1990s, it's not necessarily going to tell us what's happening 10 years down the road. And I'll just leave, and that's just a picture of all the fish in a fish pen, and I'll entertain any questions if there is any. It can. I mean, in some places like Norway, there aren't any native populations, so there's no native-run salmon, and everything that's out in the wild is all wild-caught that are farm-raised that have gotten wild. But yeah, you certainly can get infections transmitted from the pen stock to the wild, but you can also get the reverse. The wild can transmit it to the pen stock as well. Yes, back there. Didn't hear the last part.
What do you think about controlling gene
phages? Well, I'm not sure that phages would work for that. They are there's a woman down in Evergreen who's looking at phage therapy for treatment, and there is a big group in Rockefeller using the enzymes that phage use to lyse their host bacteria as potential topical agents. Phage, to my knowledge, haven't had that much interaction with transfer of genes except in transduction, which is relatively not important in this bigger scheme, but people are looking at potential agents that would reduce or eliminate gene exchange, and that nothing has come to the point of even phase one trials or anything, but people, that's one thing people are looking at to try and inhibit that.
Thank you so much.
Well, I hope that was
fascinating.
Was helpful and not
that was so good, but it connected to everyone.
You know, I didn't want to do too much to